Welcome, fiends. It's your boy, Nima. I got some anarchy gumbo that's been just sitting here marinating for you. Sit in the fridge for a little bit, but you know the flavor gets better when it's like that. I was on a show with my friend Rodney Smith. He does the Freedom Experiment podcast. He's a little new to the game, so there's a bit of an audio quality disparity, but I chopped it up nice and sweet for you. It should be good listening. Check it out.
This is Rodney Smith on the Freedom Experiment, and I have a guest on the show. His name is Nima, and I'll go ahead and allow him to introduce himself.
All right. Thank you, Rodney. Yeah, my name is Nima Vedati. I currently do a podcast with my friend Michael W. Dean. It's called Freedom Fiends. A lot of people seem to like it. You know, it's coming up in the world. We've also made a movie together called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. We made that movie while I was a TV reporter. I was actually in the mainstream media for a little bit. Spent about 3.5 years reporting for an ABC affiliate and a CBS affiliate in smaller to middle markets, and just it was crushing my soul because I felt like it was biased towards the state. And as an anarchist, as somebody that applies morals across the board, I couldn't do it and still keep my conscience intact. So now I do mostly independent media, and I try to pick up a buck here and there from other odd jobs and looking for more ways to expand my repertoire of making an honest living rather than a dishonest living.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I've had Michael Dean on. That's how I got your information. He was a great addition to my podcast.
Yeah, I listened to it last night. It was a really fun show.
Yeah, everybody enjoys that one. They really like Michael, so I knew you would be a great one on the podcast.
All right. Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know since I've seen some of your clips on YouTube when you did the broadcasting.
Okay.
Is there any way you could explain how the media, the mainstream media is different from what we're doing right now? Is there a big man controlling things in the mainstream media, or how is the information controlled?
It's a mix of things. The big man isn't always a man. The big man would be probably your news director, has the tightest control on what you say and how you say it, and more than that, what stories you cover. That's the big way that they can control what gets on their air. Is the way it works in most TV stations across the country, local news stations at least, is there's a news meeting every morning. Everybody sits down around a little table. They all pitch ideas for what they're supposed to be working on that day, you know, what stories they're going to cover. Usually, you know, you cover 2 to 3 stories. One of them is a big story that you call a package that, you know, has multiple interviews, sound bites, and then you talking over it, doing voiceover, and then a little stand-up of you in the microphone saying something really dramatic. You know, we've all seen it. It's really cheesy stuff. But you pitch ideas. Your news director pretty much sets the tone because she says, no, you can't do that, or no, I don't really think our audience will care about that. What I've found more so than in my first job, but in my second job, which was a bigger market, I found that there was a lot of control that way. There can never be a story where I pitched the government or the state as the villain. If there was, then even after I did the story, for instance, one story was about the state of Washington, because it was in Washington state, they were going to impose massive new restrictions on home daycares. And this was to include anybody that just watched kids from next door, even. Like, you do a favor to your neighbor by watching their kids every day. Couldn't do that anymore. Had to get licensed, had to have people inspect your house, had to have more expensive play equipment because it had to meet certain standards. This kind of thing was going to put people out of business, even small businesses that they barely profited from. And it was going to be very onerous. And in the end, it was going to end up hurting kids and hurting parents because the parents couldn't afford to go to big time daycares. That's why they would let their neighbor down the street or the one lady who always watches the kids watch the kids. It was a very, very horrible kind of a regulation. And so I was going to do a story about that. They let me do the story just because it affected kids and parents. And that's the big thing is kids and parents and soccer moms. But then they wrote into it stuff that didn't even make sense. Like I did attempt to contact the state. I talked to them for a little bit. They gave their 2 cents. But the way they edited it, when it came time for me to speak it, it ended up being, well, without this, you know, the kids would die of bad food, or the kids wouldn't be educated properly and would end up failing at school. Really sensational stuff that wasn't really backed up, didn't have any attribution, just threw a sentence in there. And the way it worked at that bigger market, and I saw the trend that the higher I would go, the more it would be like this, to where they just throw stuff in there, they sensationalize it. Before you voice the story, you have to end up saying that. I did a few times, you know, go confront the news director and say, hey, I don't really feel like saying this. And she'd be like, just say it, you know. So I couldn't keep doing that anymore.
So then you could tell she was getting pressure from somewhere else higher than herself then?
No. See, I'm not sure about that. I think the other pressure, the main pressure is the news director. I think the other pressure is the culture as a whole. It's more of a horizontal enforcement than anything, because you talk to the other reporters, you hear about what they're working on, and even at the news meeting, there's a very thick sense of statism. And I think it's the indoctrination from the journalism schools that we all went to, because we all went to journalism school at you know, probably a bigger university. And the narrative you learn in journalism school is that you are a public servant, the government is there to protect the people, and you must make sure that the government does its job properly of protecting the people. There's barely any narrative about the government doing anything wrong, unless it's some kind of overt, obvious corruption or a sex scandal, of course, you know, like David Petraeus.
Okay.
So it's mostly other reporters. And the culture in the newsroom is so thickly statist that I think there's a bias towards the status quo, is what I called it. Even if a newsroom isn't, you know, a right-wing bias or a left-wing bias, they're still both biased towards the status quo or the way things work now or the state oppression of people. And they're also legal positivist, right? So if there's a law, then that's the most moral thing. For instance, I was tasked with going out and shooting a story on cell phones, right? So the state of Washington had passed – or no, it was the city. It was the city I was in passed this law that you can't drive with a cell phone. It was a primary offense now. So if you were driving while talking on the cell phone, a cop could pull you over just for that and give you a ticket. And so they told me to go out in a median, right, turn on the camera and try to film people on the low, like sneaking around filming people on their cell phones, like real silly and sensationalist, right? Like, oh, the cell phone people are going to come get you.
Right.
And you know, I was like, whatever. I just want to get this day over with. So I go out and do it, and I come back, and the main anchor, who's like this big, white, gray hair, mustachioed, always had a cigar in his mouth, kind of, you know, kind of a stereotype. He's like, oh, how many did you get? And I was like, oh, it's like 14 people. And he's like, oh, yeah, I don't think it's only like 14 people. That's like you just saw 14 bank robberies. I was just thinking, really? Is that how you feel? And he's like, they're both against the law. You know, so that's the kind of mentality that I found. It wasn't as bad when I was in Wyoming, because Wyoming's the least populous state. You know, there's not a whole lot of people that really love the government and really feel statist. Really, the only statism I found there was, you know, love and undying gratitude and support and unquestioning the military. It was all about, you know, military, which kind of grated on me too. But the thing about in Wyoming is it was such a small outfit that I had a lot of autonomy. You know, I didn't really have a whole lot of people shooting down my story ideas, and I didn't have anybody editing and rewriting my stories. Like, whatever I wrote got to go on air, and plus I produced the weekend show myself. So
okay.
I got to set the whole tone for the show on the weekend. But I found that once you get into bigger markets, there's much more control, and there's much less say for the individual reporter. And there's much less diversity in the terms of how the stories get told and what stories get told. In the bigger markets, I feel like there's a narrative that the news director and the other reporters and the culture of the newsroom wants to push, and that's the narrative that gets pushed.
Wow. Okay, so what you're saying is that because people grow up in these statist government schools, which is the same when you go to a journalism school and mm-hmm. college and higher education, that
yeah.
basically it's just feeding into itself, that everybody wants to protect the state because it's been portrayed as the best thing possible.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you don't need a conspiracy, then if everybody already believes the same thing, right? Like Bill O'Reilly, you don't need somebody telling Bill O'Reilly exactly what to say because he already believes in status ideas.
Right, right. He's a douchebag himself. He doesn't need a higher douchebag telling him what to say.
Right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And that's how I feel. And the news director is there to be the gatekeeper and to make sure that nobody diverges from the narrative and diverges from the narrow spectrum of things you can cover. But they're just a gatekeeper. You know, I feel like you're right. It's all internal to us because it's all what we've been indoctrinated in for our 12 years of growing up and for our time we spent in college.
Right. I want to contrast that. Like, I played major college basketball at Purdue University, and each year we would have some type of media specialist come in and coach us on the type of answers that we give to the media. So nothing like that is going on with the news networks, right? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't go on with the network itself, but the people we talk to, it definitely does go on. Like what you guys had at Purdue, police have that, right? So at every police department, and it was a really interesting study when I was in Washington State, because I was in a place called the Tri-Cities. So there were three distinct city governments that we would cover on a regular basis. And each of them had their own what they call PIO. Now, for the most part, any information the police give the reporters by policy of the police department has to go through this one guy, this PIO. He calls the shots. And if he doesn't like a reporter, if he doesn't like the way a reporter covered a story, he can just not answer his calls. He can just tell the other police officers not to talk to the reporter. And then the reporter has to go file a Freedom of Information request and wait, you know, a month. By that time, the story's already old and nobody wants to hear it, and the news director doesn't want it to go on air. You know, the prosecutor's office is the same way. All the city government agencies kept a very tight hold on what information got out. And the sad thing is people do pay tax money for these PIOs and officers in general, city government officials in general, to go through training. Like, they'll have workshops where they'll go get trained on how to deal with the media. You know, I'm sure that they pitch it so we can better handle giving information out to the public. But what it really is them figuring out how to cover their ass, how to lie, and how to spin things. And so basically the taxpayer pays for cops to get trained on how to lie and how to spin things when they do something like shoot somebody dead who didn't deserve it, or it's questionable whether or not they deserved it.
Right. And that gets into the whole thing that I wanted to talk about, is freedom and morality. Is this type of news and coverage actually giving people the freedom of information that they're looking for? Is it moral to spin things and lie to them instead of giving them the information of what really happened? Like, how do you see morals? What are morals to you?
To me, yeah, that's an important question. To me, morals are the ones that are they're the rules that are natural to humanity, right? They're natural law. Stefan Molyneux calls it universally preferable behavior. And it basically just boils down to the non-aggression principle, which Michael sort of explained on the last show. And any or most libertarians or anarchists will point to the non-aggression principle. Basically, it states that it's immoral to aggress, you know, impose your will through force on others' property. That property, of course, includes people, because people own themselves. So inherent in this statement of the non-aggression principle is, you know, murder, because somebody else owns their body. You can't impose your will by killing them because you want them to die. I'm sure they don't want to die.
Right.
You can't steal from them because that's their property they own. You can't rape them because they also own their body. And they, if they don't want to, you know, engage in sex with you and you force them to, you're imposing your will. You're aggressing against them. Fraud, because you lie – you under false pretenses get somebody to spend their money. So basically you steal their money under false pretenses. So fraud would be included. Basically all of the things that humans instinctually consider wrong, that you get that feeling and you have a conscience and you're like, wow, that's really wrong. Those are all morals. So to me, if a law doesn't stem from that, then it's an unjust law. And other things, you know, are cultural, right? We've had this discussion of moral relativism. Anything else on top of the non-aggression principle, I would call, you know, an aesthetic or a custom. Like Muslim women wearing a hijab, or Baptist women, you know, not dancing or thinking dancing is wrong, or Mormons wearing underwear to bed at night, you know, long underwear all over their bodies. All those kinds of things to me are nothing more than customs, because they're not universally agreed upon among humanity. They're looked to from some kind of set of customs, which we call a culture or a religion. And those things are fine, and I don't think we should impose that or change that. If people want to do that, that's voluntary and that's fine because they're choosing it. There's no aggression involved. It's only when you cross that line of forcing somebody and imposing a different will upon somebody or a different choice that somebody wouldn't have made without your imposition.
Right. I agree with you. A lot of the arguments that I get is like, well, what about Hitler? He naturally thought killing was right, so he had a different set of morals, didn't he? Didn't he, Nima? Didn't Hitler have a different set of morals, Nima?
Well, maybe he did in his mind, but he was wrong. I mean, just because he believed in something, that doesn't make it right. You know, if I believe in my heart that 2 + 2 = 5, I can believe it all I want. And to me, you know, that's how I follow my life is, that whenever I do math, I make sure that 2 + 2 = 5. That's fine, but it's wrong. And I will incur any consequences of my wrongness. Like when I go to pay bills at the end of the month and all my money's off, it's because I was wrong. Because you can't break the natural law. You can't break laws of physics. You can ignore them and pretend they're not there, but you can't change them.
Right. And I've thought about those questions that I get, and this is what I came up. Tell me what you think about this. If different cultures, like Islamic cultures, and other cultures like Hitler, for example, where killing Jews and stuff was rampant in that culture. If they didn't think killing and stealing was right, then why do all of these cultures have a punishment for somebody actually killing and stealing then?
Ah, see.
You see what I'm saying? So that proves that there's not a different set of morals. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you hit it on the head, right? Because in Hitler's society, in his envisionment of the way the world worked, if a Jew would have killed an SS guard, or if even a regular German would have been treasonous and killed an SS guard, the full weight of the Reich would have been stomped down on that person, right?
Exactly.
It would have been wrong. So where they drew a line is they made up a false distinction. They said, well, this group, it's okay to have a different set of morals than this group. So that type of moral relativism is what caused the Holocaust. It's what allowed people to justify the Holocaust in their mind is our dear leader, our Führer, when he does things like murder or order murder or steal or gas Jews, it's okay. I couldn't do that because I'm not the Führer, you know.
And that's how I put it, and that's why now I think about the state and morality is that people don't believe there's a different set of morals, but they believe there are certain people that can suspend morality,
yes,
for whatever reason that is.
Yeah, exactly. And what I think the reason is the same reason you have that culture of status quo bias in a newsroom. It's because our instincts are beaten out of us, and culture, or not culture, but statism is forced into us
for
12 years, right? I mean, you grow up. And what do kids say, you know, by the time it's first or second grade, and you ask them what they want to be, you know, it'll all be police officer. Fireman.
Yeah.
And it's more than just school. It's TV. TV is huge. I think TV is really have you ever read 1984, George Orwell's 1984?
Yeah, we read that in high school. I love that book.
Yeah, my favorite book too. And my wife's favorite book. It's an amazing book. And if most people have read it, but if you haven't read it and you're listening, please go read it. It's also just great literature. But in 1984, you know, there's telescreens. The state is always watching them. And it's a little bit different because in the telescreen, they could see you too. It was a two-way screen. But the concept of constantly being plugged in to what the state wants you to hear, I think that's the same. And I think that's what we have today. And what that is TV. Because you can watch TV. You will rarely, if ever, see a dissenting view on the state. And whenever you watch cop shows, cops are always the good guys. And whenever they show them doing something immoral or wrong, it's justified in the end because they just had to get their hands a little dirty to get the bad guy, right? And all they do in those cop shows is find mass murderers and really nasty people that would do horrible things. When the reality of being a cop is most of the time you're forcing the government's will on people, like doing drug stings, throwing people in cages for doing drugs, doing traffic things, stops, you know, stopping people and seeing if they're drunk while they're driving, writing people tickets, basically enforcing laws that are victimless crimes, and taking money from people and revenue gathering. That's the average everyday thing a cop's doing. But do you see any TV shows like that? No.
Not at all.
I agree. And it's crazy because if these police were owned by private citizens, the owners wouldn't stand for the complaints they would get from being pulled from the cops pulling people over for no reason. Yeah. I just got pulled over 3 days ago. The cop told me that he pulled me over because I had my tassels on the rearview mirror and it was obstructing my view.
Yeah, seriously. If you were his customer, do you think he would do that?
No way.
Not at all. No, because you decide what obstructs your view. I mean, how long have you been driving with those tassels on your car? I would say a long time, right?
Exactly, right.
Yeah. And have you ever felt scared or gotten in a wreck because of those tassels?
No, I've never been in a wreck.
Yeah, exactly. It was an excuse for him. And it's because he doesn't answer to you. His paycheck will come to his house. He will get his paycheck or it'll get electronically deposited into his bank account no matter what the public thinks of him. He could be the worst, nastiest, meanest cop in the world. He could have horrible customer service. He's still going to get his 60 grand a year no matter what.
No matter what. I agree. Well, how would you address this, Nima? Let me ask you this. I was talking to this one young lady about statism, and she happened to be on government assistance because, you know, she doesn't make a high income. And mm-hmm. I was trying to explain to her that money comes from, you know, taxation from working people. Yeah. And that, you know, there's a better way for you to get what you need. But she felt that it was – and then I explained to her that it comes from us and that it's like stealing since the government didn't ask us. But she thought it was okay. Like, how do you get people to understand that stealing from the rich is not a good thing?
Why did she give you a reason why she thought it was okay?
Because, and that's the other issue I was going to ask you about. It's not just her. Like, the recent podcast I did, I just posted it, so you didn't have a chance to hear it, but everybody believes that rich people are a big part of the reason why we have unemployment and a bad economy.
Yeah.
Well, they think they're justified when the government takes their money and redistributes it to the poor.
Right. Well, see, it's again, it's a lack of economic understanding, and it's the government keeping us in the dark in the first place. Even that term, redistribution of wealth, it implies that the wealth was somehow distributed in the first place, you know, unfairly. But the wealth was never distributed. There was never an on high power with a bunch of wealth, and the people who could kiss ass the most got the most money. Well, maybe that is kind of how it works, actually, in our society. But that's not the way it should work. And there's a difference between rich people that it's important to make a distinction. Some people are well off and wealthy because they came to the market with a product or something that people really wanted, and so by making people happy, people gave them a lot of money. You know, think of Jay-Z, right? Jay-Z, you know, I don't see in his history whatever is true or not. You know, I don't know if he really sold drugs or whatever, but it seems like the narrative of Jay-Z is you know, he was always trying to give people what they wanted, whether it was giving crack to the fiends, or, you know, he makes that same parallel with music. He says the rap game is just like the crack game, and he just wants to give people what they want. And he's got almost $1 billion or something just for making people happy, you know. And I still listen to Reasonable Doubt, you know, his first album, like once a month at least, and it's given me a lot of joy. And so he's rich for a very good thing. I don't see any kind of cause to tax him, to make him pay somebody else to steal money from him. But then there's also evil rich people, right? Mm-hmm. Like politicians or people on the board of something like General Electric, who probably have a revolving door through different government regulatory bodies. They write laws and regulations that keep GE on the top of the pile, keep GE in pretty much a monopoly status. And GE gets a lot of government contract money, which is stolen in the first place through taxation, and then uses it to build things like weapons and weapon systems and support services for military operations. So they steal money, a bunch of money from people, and then use that stolen money to kill people in other parts of the world. Those kinds of rich people are obviously did not acquire their wealth through moral means. But so I think first it's important to make that distinction. And next, it's important to also note that taxing the so-called rich or taxing people is not a solution to keeping the economy going. Even if you taxed all the rich people at some outrageous rate, like 90% or something, even if you took all the money all the rich people in the country had or made that year, you still wouldn't fund the government for more than a few days or a few weeks. The federal government spends much more money than the richest people in the country even make. The government spending is I think like 50% of GDP or something outrageous like that. And something like 50% of people get their money from the government in some way, either through something as obvious as a welfare check or something as you kind of have to think outside of the box as being for a private company, but being a military contractor, to where all your revenue comes from the government, although, you know, with a little bit of step of a removal there. So but then again, I don't know how to really explain that to somebody without giving them a long economics lesson.
Right, and that's what I found myself getting into, and because I agree with you that they don't understand basic economics, because the next comment out of her mouth was, well, we should just print more money. And I was like, oh, no, that was the worst thing you could do. Cause inflation.
Yeah. Well, when you print money, which you still are devaluing the currency, so you're taking the money away. I mean, you can print it all you want. I mean, and people should know better for that one, because there was an episode of DuckTales about it, if you ever watched cartoons when you was a kid. So, yeah, I think it stems from economic ignorance. And then I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, too, when you said that, well, she was like, well, you know, other people do it. You know, if you see other people getting money this way, you don't think anything wrong of it. It's kind of hard, especially I've got a family member who was in the military for 20 years and he's disabled now. He doesn't work at all, and he makes, I guess he, I don't know if he makes a pretty good living, but he lives well. You know, he gets disability, Social Security already, even though he's not old enough for it, and some kind of pension. He supports himself and his wife and doesn't really have to do anything, and lives better than me, who works full time and tries to support my wife. And I'm not really going to go to him and be like, well, you shouldn't get any money because you're not doing any work. Because, you know, he's disabled. He's a member of my family. And he did spend 20 years in the military. And when he did that, he thought, you know, I'm doing this so that I can get my retirement so that one day I'm okay. So it's sad when people grow up thinking, you know, this is what I got to do to be okay. They don't really think of the morality about it because nobody ever told them.
Right.
They never knew that. So they bet their whole life on this government largesse keeping them afloat. And it's hard to say something like, well, it's stolen money, so you should feel bad about it.
Right. And that's not what I did when I was talking to her. That's what I tried to tell her, that I'm not telling you that I think it should be immediately taken from you. And I think everybody should live a hard life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you have to sort of – I don't know what you have to do, but that is a problem that needs to be addressed in how we get from here to there. And different people go about it different ways. Like even Ron Paul, you know, liberals would always get onto him as this mean old racist man who just wants to steal everybody's money and take money away from old ladies and cut off your Social Security and your welfare and all that. But he would always say, the first thing we do is we cut the overseas empire. bring the troops home now. Stop giving billions of dollars of contract to Lockheed Martin and General Electric and General Dynamics. Stop the military-industrial complex, because really that is the vast majority of how money gets wasted. And it doesn't really benefit anybody. There's no – I guess it does. It benefits the people who get rich off of it. But it doesn't benefit the average person. You know, it doesn't benefit the average person in America, because the currency gets devalued because they print money and borrow money to fund it. And it doesn't help the average person in the world, because innocent people die in places like North Africa and the Middle East, you know, all the time from drone bombings and other things like sanctions. You know, even when we're not bombing a country, in a place like Iran, we impose sanctions on them, which are pretty much an act of war. It's like a blockade. It's like saying, well, no country should be allowed to give Iran this type of medicine or this type of petrochemical. It's really like starving them off.
Right. Was that similar to like something like the Treaty of Versailles?
Yeah, in a way, because the Treaty of Versailles, it was kind of worse, the Treaty of Versailles, because it also imposed reparations. It told Germans that they had to pay for all the destruction of World War I, and that was really how it hindered them. But yeah, doing something like that, even though it's not active warfare,
when you impose the same effect.
Yeah, it had the same effect, and it made the average German so resentful of this economic warfare that was being waged upon them that it allowed somebody like Hitler to rise to power on the promises that he would stop the people from he would stop the outsiders from interfering in the German economy.
Ugh, I'm so sick of looking at Steve's wedding pics, and I'm all out of passive-aggressive comments. What else am I supposed to do at work all day?
Sick of stalking your ex on Facebook?
Yeah!
Are you all out of cute cats and autocorrect mishaps to lolat?
Duh!
Freedom Fiends to the rescue! The Fiends now have a blog. Read all about the latest tyranny today. Dream about lip pair. Laugh while Western civilization collapses. Just click on the cat icon to the right of freedomfiends.com. Freedom Fiends blog. Read it!
Right. All right. Well, let me ask you this then. I have a real knowledgeable gentleman that I talk to a lot about these libertarian and anarchy ideas, and he seems to believe that since the idea of statism is so rampant in people's minds, that's a great reason for keeping it in existence, but just minimizing government. What do you say to people like that? Because he recognizes that it's just a mind state, but he doesn't want to work towards changing the mindset.
No, the mind state is the most important thing that we change, in my view, because you never get to that point. And every example you've given me and that I've given you, the problem is how people think about what's going on in the world. It's how people view the state. It's that moral relativism where they give the state a pass to do things like steal from people and call it theft, or murder people and call it law enforcement or war. The mindset's the most important part. The government, the people who actually do the evil work of the state, is a very small minority of people who call the shots. The vast majority of the reason why they can get away with it is because of obedience. It's because their lackeys and the public in general buys their story. So the mindset is the first thing that has to change. And I think really it's the only thing. Like, if everybody believed the way you and I believe right now, if everybody saw the state as being an aggressive force in society that is antisocial and does nothing but harm the world, you wouldn't need to dissolve government, because nobody would become involved in government in the first place. If everybody saw that, you wouldn't need an election to elect somebody to tear down the government. Nobody would just people would just stop paying their taxes.
But Nima, show up to vote. Nima, if there's no government, then there'll be horrible monopolies like Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. Nima, they'll just buy up everything.
Yeah, that's the next one they go to.
Yeah,
and Rockefeller and Carnegie, they were deep in the government, right? They had people giving them kickbacks, or they gave out kickbacks. They massaged the Senate and the Congress to make sure that the regulations favored them. They basically used the tools of the state to make sure that they had a monopoly on what they were doing. And they also used the state militarily. Like, when people were building railroads, they relied on the government to send troops out to massacre, to genocide a whole group of people, you know, the Indians.
Right.
So without this big state apparatus, I don't think you can have these massive corporate entities that do evil, or these massive monopolies, right? You know, a good way to look at it is, what do you have to do to end a monopoly or to end any kind of business? You just stop buying their products, right? I mean, look at Blockbuster. Did we have to have the government step in and close Blockbuster down and say, hey, stop renting out videos. Nobody does that anymore. You're wasting all this space because nobody's going to drive to your store anyway. Nobody had to do that. People just sat on their ass and signed up for Netflix.
Right, and so really you're saying true competition,
right. If the world doesn't want something, if the public and the people who buy things don't want something to exist, it will cease to exist very soon. That's the beauty of the market, is that it is nothing but people's desires in aggregate. The market is just a reflection of what people really want. And if you let what people really want, if you let that reflection shine through without putting roadblocks and mirrors and curtains around it, then you will get a society, you will get a world that is an image or an example of what people really do want.
That's right. I totally agree. Totally agree. But how do you handle those arguments though about the big monopolies that'll rise up if there's no government? And after you address that, well, if there's no government, Nima, then everybody will just start killing and stealing.
Okay. So first, yeah, monopolies. Well, first, it's important to note that when people generally think of monopolies, they think of, you know, the corporate state run amok, and everybody makes this mistake, not just people who are economically ignorant, but anybody who's indoctrinated, and even not, like even dissenters like Noam Chomsky. He basically has a statement where he says, well, without government, you would have corporations run amok. But what they fail to miss is that corporations are an entity of the government.
Exactly.
Without the government, who starts a corporation, but who incorporates a company? It's the government.
Yep.
And then they impose all these kinds of extra powers to the corporation. And the other thing about a corporation is it's basically set up to keep the people who run it from getting into trouble if the business goes out of business or if there's some kind of big problem. That's why they call it limited liability.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Right? So would that – I don't know if that would really exist in a free market without a conceived of arbitrary government status to limit somebody's liability. I don't know if we would have that. People wouldn't stand for it, right? They wouldn't be like, no, if it doesn't matter what kind of thing you wrote on paper, if you polluted my land, if your methane, river of methane, killed all my crops and my cows and gave my family diseases and cancer, you know, that's coming out of your ass. I don't care what kind of limited liability there is. So that's the first thing. The second thing about, you know, monopoly is it seems like a very self-defeating logic to say, well, we don't want there to be giant monopolies, so instead, let's have this one giant monopoly to take care of everything, which is what the government is. The government, even non-anarchists, political scientists, define the government as a monopoly of force on a given geographical region.
Right.
So you can't say, well, I'm so scared of monopolies, so my idea to prevent me from being scared is to have one massive monopoly. It's just silly.
I agree. It's just a walking contradiction. I want to prevent people from stealing, so I'm going to steal from you via taxes.
Right.
I want to prevent wars, so I'm going to start one.
Yeah, exactly. It's just logic that doesn't make any sense. But because people – because that's the other thing is people give politicians and they give the media a status that they don't deserve, a status of trust. Like, what reason does anybody have to ever trust something a politician says? I don't see any reason in the world. There's no incentive for a politician to do anything but tell you what you want to hear, but tell you what he wants you to hear, to lie to you in order to increase his power. There's no other incentive or market force to make a politician do anything but that.
Exactly. And that's what people don't see. And that's why I blame a lot of of it on the public school systems, because mm-hmm. everything we're talking about is critical thinking and philosophy. If you're yep. not introduced to those ideas, it'll be hard to break these large institutions down the way we yep. are.
Yeah, yeah. And it really is – it's become a religion, right? You get a lot of people who blame religion for a lot of the world's ills and indoctrination. And yeah, maybe that did happen, but I think that's old news, right? I feel like that was centuries ago when the religious powers were imposing their will on people and people really bowed down to them and they were the violent ones. But even then, they were doing things very similar to the state. And now the new religion is the religion of the government, right? People have replaced God off that throne and instead put the government, the state. And if you don't believe me, go spend a day with your kid at kindergarten and watch him recite the Pledge of Allegiance. A pledge of allegiance to a government he knows nothing about. Watch him sing patriotic songs, which are just hymns to the state, and watch them worship the patron saints, which are the presidents. You know, they all have that chart of the presidents, and they put these people on a pedestal.
Oh, people are turning my podcast off now, Nima, because of I'm sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, you're right, and because of that, you're right. People would turn it off, and the reason is because it's not necessarily a logical or reasonable thing to them. It's not in their brain; it's in their heart.
Right.
So when you attack something so close to somebody's heart, and there's that emotional religious attachment to it, people get scared. They get angry. And they respond with nothing but derision whenever you try to tell them something outside of this religiosity they have towards the state.
Right. I agree.
Because it's scary for them. I have some liberal friends in Utah, one who's been my friend for years and years and years and years. And he gets deathly afraid when I'm talking about this stuff. And it affects him personally, right? He's got a lot of health problems and to him, it doesn't go much further than what in the world would I do if the government didn't pay for my medicine?
Right.
He doesn't think any further than that. He thinks, oh my God, I would be up Schitt's Creek without a paddle if I didn't have this godlike institution to provide for my needs.
Right.
And go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think probably the same thing. That's understandable.
Yeah. Yeah, it is understandable. And that's why it's our job to do like we were talking about earlier is to change that mindset, to show people alternatives, to show people that libertarians, anarchists, we're the ones who are truly passionate about the poor and about people. Because we apply morals across the board. We don't think it's fair for cops to do things like beat homeless people to death like they do in Seattle. We don't give that any kind of quarter. We don't think police should have that power. And also because the biggest engine of prosperity is freedom, basically. And I know that sounds like a bromide, but let me put it this way. The government cannot do any kind of net positive, right? Any kind of money they redistribute or give out, they've had to take that money out in the first place. It's a zero-sum game. So what the government does is suck up money, and it's not even a true siphon. It sponges away. There's leaks. There's statistics that when it comes to government welfare and government social services programs, something like 20% of the revenue collected gets to the intended benefactors or beneficiaries. So 20% of the taxes and Federal Reserve money that gets printed that's supposed to go to welfare, only 20% gets to the person who gets the check. The other 80% gets lost in the government bureaucracy. So just imagine if you had that 80% of money and that didn't get taken out in the first place. And also taxes. Just imagine and I'm not talking about income taxes here. I'm talking about what we buy is taxed along various lines of production, right? So if I'm making a pencil, the wood is taxed. I'm also paying for various government surveys on the land that was forested. I'm also paying for various government surveys on the graphite that was mined in the graphite mine. I'm paying taxes for the workers in the factory who built the pencil. I'm paying taxes for the workers who built the factory. All those are built in to the cost of the good. And And the government taxes it both ways, right? They tax the seller and they tax the buyer.
The buyer, yeah. But Nima, so, Nima, these taxes are our duty. There are people overseas right now, Nima, fighting for our freedom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If they were fighting for our freedom, they would be in Washington, D.C. laying siege to the White House. Yeah, I mean, think about who takes your freedom away. How has any Afghani, how has any Libyan, how has any Iraqi ever personally taken an American's freedom?
Well, they ran a plane into the World Trade Center, Nima.
Well, those were Saudis. We don't have any beef with Saudi Arabia. Yes, when the Saudis did 9/11, those people took the biggest part of freedom and liberty they can take from a human being. They took their lives. They did indeed. But they are already dead. There were something like 100 to 200 people who were actually in Al-Qaeda. And we don't know what percentage of those actual Al-Qaeda members actually were in the planning and things like that. Or the CIA won't tell us, you know, the exact numbers. So the average person over there fighting for, what, 10, 11 years now? In Afghanistan and Iraq, they're not attacking or laying any kind of vengeance on the people who actually did the 9/11 attack. They're basically wasting resources to kill a lot of innocent people to keep those geographical regions under the American boot, to make Israel happy because Israel wants to expand a lot in the region and they want less of a power counterbalance with nations like Iraq, Syria, and Iran. They don't want to have anybody in the region who can challenge them when they continue to expand. So there's a lot of reasons for the war, but I can't see any of them as troops fighting for our freedom, especially because look at how much of our freedom we've lost since the war, the most recent round of wars started. The president can literally just scoop us up out of nowhere and detain us indefinitely. Now, I would say the government probably already could do that, but now it's explicit. They say it. They come out right and say it to our face that if we want to arrest you and throw you in a cage forever and ever, no matter what, without any questions asked, we can do that. They've also killed an American citizen with a drone strike and his son, who was an American citizen, who had nothing to do with anything. Anwar al-Zahiri, al-Awlaki. They killed him. They didn't indict him. He didn't go to court. He was an American citizen. Yeah, he made some horrible YouTubes criticizing the American government and American foreign policy. But so do I. You know, all I do all day long is make media criticizing American policy, foreign and domestic. That's all they had on him. At least that's all they told us. If they had some other evidence on him, why don't they say it to us? Not only did they kill him, but then in a separate strike, they killed his 16-year-old son. A 16-year-old. The kid probably didn't know anything more than riding on skateboards and listening to Young Moolah Baby, you know.
Do you look at Homeland? That sounds like what the whole show Homeland is about. Do you watch it on Showtime?
No.
Same scenario where the United States authorized a drone attack on a suspected terrorist, and it ends up killing the terrorist's son.
Wow. No, I didn't know about that.
It's the exact same scenario of what you just described of real life.
Wow. I'm wondering if it was influenced by that.
It had to have been.
Yeah. Is it a good show? Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I love watching it.
Homeland. All right.
Homeland, yeah.
I'll have to do what I can do to get it. I'm looking for a new show to watch. Me and the wife just finished watching the first two seasons of Hell on Wheels.
Oh, how's that?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. Michael showed it to me, my podcast partner, and I just fell in love with it. It's gritty and grimy, and I wouldn't consider it a libertarian paradise because the state is there and there is a lot of aggression and evil. But the state is so much less powerful than it is now. So in that sense, it's kind of freeing. Like there's a scene where they're about to hang the protagonist. He's about to be hung. And he didn't actually do the crime, right? He didn't do the murder. He watched it happen, but he didn't do it. There's no trial. They're just going to hang him. And he escapes, you know? He's in a wooden boxcar that is chained up, and he's able to get a little piece of an iron nail and use it to pick the lock and escape. And, you know, back then, 150 years ago, 160 years ago, the state didn't have so much more power over us technologically, right?
Right.
I mean, who could escape from a modern prison?
Not many people.
And if you do, now you have this massive surveillance state to where there's cameras everywhere. There's facial recognition software. You're not going to be on the run for long.
Right.
And then they can drone you. I imagine they would claim the right, and they will probably do that at one point domestically. I don't know how long it is down the road, but I think it's inevitable. So. The beauty of Hell on Wheels is that it's this simpler time when the best the government could do is send more people at you, but they had the same weapons. I have a lever-action rifle. They have a lever-action rifle. We all have the same weapons. That doesn't exist anymore. You know, I don't have an aircraft carrier. I don't have a Predator drone. I don't have Hellfire missiles or cruise missiles. The state has become so massive that there's no way to escape it when it's wrong. When it's wrong, it's like this Kafka-esque horribleness where no matter how wrong it is, there's nothing you can do about it. You don't have any recourse. It's scary.
Right.
So, yeah, that was sort of my reading of Hell on Wheels and what I enjoyed about it, at least.
I'm going to have to check that out. Any zombies in it, or is it just regular people?
No, there's no sort of mysticism. I've never been big on zombies and vampires and things like that. I just can't suspend my disbelief, you know. I can't really get into it. It's just sort of, it's regular people. It's about, they're building railroads, and they have these temporary towns they call Hell on Wheels, you know, as they're building the railroad. There's Indians that, of course, don't like their land being encroached upon, so there's that. There's also a big contingent of Irish immigrants and a big contingent of freed slaves, because it's set right after the Civil War. And so there's this interplay of these different groups. You know, the Irish, they hate the freed slaves. And one of them says, you know, it's because we were the race that everybody was racist about in Europe. You know, we were the black people of Europe, and we don't want to be the low people on the totem pole anymore. So they're very violent and racist towards the black people. And the slaves, you know, there's some nice stories of freedom there. Like the main guy is played by Common, you know, the rapper.
Okay.
And he actually gets he gets taught how to shoot, and he gets armed, and it's a really liberating thing to watch him, you know, because he was a slave when he was a kid, but I guess he was kind of half and half. Like, his dad was the plantation owner, so he's always had this weird internal conflict. And he was taught to read when he was young, and other people weren't. And he sort of gets these guns, and he doesn't really know who to be. Like, he doesn't know if he doesn't really feel accepted among the rest of the slaves anymore. So there's this nice conflict there with Common, and it's just a wonderful show to watch. I would highly recommend it.
Wow, yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah,
I think you got me. I think I'll watch it now.
Okay.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, not that I can think of, unless you have any other questions for me.
Nope, I can't think of anything either. Go ahead.
I guess maybe I have a couple questions for you. You live in Chicago, right?
Yes.
Okay. What is the average attitude on the street there? Like, do you have friends who are liberty people? Is there a liberty community there? Or do you feel sort of alone in a sea of statism?
I feel alone in a sea of statism. Most people that I talk to about these ideas, they like some of the stuff that I talk about. But for the most part, it's all about Obama's back in office, and then it doesn't go any further than that.
Yeah. How do people feel about the gun issue? Because Chicago is always sort of this boilerplate city whenever the gun rights debate comes up. And there was some changes there recently, but I think the city is still very anti-gun. And at the same time, Chicago has, like, what, one of the highest murder rates
yeah.
in the country. I mean, do people ever make that connection that, you know, hey, everybody is out there killing people, I'd like to be able to defend myself? Or are people happy to have all these restrictions on guns?
People are happy about it. They think the state regulating who can have guns is a good thing. They think that that's going to lead to a reduction in the murder rate.
even though it hasn't for years and years.
Exactly. That's the attitude. Like, a majority of the people, white and black, they love the state. Anything the state says is good, they go along with it.
Well, I know there was, what was it, like last summer, I don't know if this really happened, but you were in Chicago. There's supposedly like flash mobs where big groups of like teenagers would come and mug people and terrorize different parts of town. Did that actually happen? Was that going on?
See, I just got here in May. I was in San Antonio before May. Yes, I'm new.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm still
San Antonio. What were you doing there?
I work for a company called CSL Plasma. We take blood plasma from people and we turn it into different types of medicines. One of the real big medicines we made was Gardasil for the HPV virus.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I transferred here. I'm from Indianapolis, so this is as close as I could get to home. So that's why I transferred here.
Are you not allowed to talk much about the details of your work?
No, I'm allowed to talk about it.
You are? How did the company feel about the controversy in Texas with Rick Perry trying to impose Gardasil on people, like make it mandatory for school kids?
See, what we did is actually create it, and then we sold it to Merck. And then sold it to the people. So, like, we have lots of patents on different types of pharmaceuticals.
Got it. So you're like Albert Einstein. You invented the theory behind it. But,
exactly.
But they were the ones that actually putting the bomb out there.
Yes.
Okay.
So that would be more of a question for Merck than us.
Okay. How do you feel about patents and IP if that's such a big part of your job?
I don't think that these intellectual property laws should exist because it's hard to determine if it's actually property. I don't think it's actually property. I mean, once I download something, I think it's mine. How I want to manipulate it is how I want to manipulate it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my thing with IP too. Is you don't have any ownership over what's in somebody else's brain, right? It's their brain first. So, if you let that information get into their brain, or if it can get in there, once it's there, there's nothing you can do about it. No, sorry, buddy.
Yeah, I agree. But a lot of people, they don't view it that way. They just think, oh, government said intellectual property rights exist, so it must exist.
Yeah, that's what we got to do to change the world, man. And I'm glad you're doing a podcast, and I really thank you for letting me come out here and give my two bits or my contribution to the work, and just keep on fighting the good fight. If here's how I view it, man, we're right, and it's obvious that we're right. So you got to be a long-term optimist, right? I think truth always wins out in the end. No matter how long people were saying the world was flat, eventually, since the world actually isn't flat, the truth was going to get out there. So that's kind of how I feel about the non-aggression principle and anarchy and liberty.
Okay. Yeah, I feel the same way as you. And I really appreciate you taking time out to talk to me, and I hope we can do it again.
Definitely, man. Just let me know.
Okay, I will. I got your info now.
All right,
man. Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah, you too. Peace.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.